This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. President Donald Trump and his administration are working to enforce the slate of executive actions that he signed in his first few days in office. In the weeks following his inauguration, state attorneys general have filed dozens of lawsuits in an attempt to block the president's actions. Vermont Attorney General Charity Clark is part of this effort. Later in the show, she'll explain her office's lawsuits against the Trump administration. At the end of the hour, we'll take a breather from politics and hear from a Northfield author, Nathaniel Ian Miller. In his new novel, he draws on his own experiences raising cattle in Vermont. But first, it's to Capitol Hill we go. This week, the Senate is voting to confirm a number of President Donald Trump's cabinet appointees. Over the past few weeks, the Senate confirmation hearings for these appointees have been heated. Vermont senior senator Bernie Sanders, an independent, has been a vocal presence at some of the hearings. Earlier this month, he pressed Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Trump's nominee to lead Health and Human Services, about an anti-vaccine organization that RFK Jr. founded. The group is currently selling baby onesies with anti-vax slogans on them.
Can you tell us now that you will, now that you are pro-vaccine, that you're going to have your organization take these products off the market?
Senator, I have no power over that organization. I'm not part of it. I resigned from the board.
Yeah, that was just a few months ago. You founded that. You certainly have power. You can make that call. Are you supportive of this?
I've had nothing to do with
leadership. Are you supportive of these onesies?
I'm supportive of vaccines.
Are you supportive of this clothing, which is militantly anti-vaccine?
I am supportive of vaccines. Right. I want good science, and I want to protect
the But you will not tell the organization you founded not to continue selling that product. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yesterday, I spoke with Senator Sanders. Our conversation began with the senator discussing which of Trump's actions will have the largest impact on Vermonters.
This is going to be a huge impact on Vermont and on the whole country, because what Trump is doing very rapidly is moving us to an oligarchic form of society. When you have the richest guy in the world worth over $400 billion, Elon Musk, running kind of wild all over Washington, single-handedly dismembering agencies that were created by Congress, when you have the three wealthiest people becoming several hundred billion dollars richer since Trump was elected, when you have billionaires all over his cabinets, that's issue number one. You're going to have a government of the billionaire class, by the billionaire class, for the billionaire class. That's number one. That impacts Vermont, every state in the union. Number two, and very frighteningly, and I speak to the veterans who have put their lives on the line defending this country, and I think back literally to the 1770s when the founding fathers created a constitution that was really quite incredible, a division of power, three branches of government, executive, legislative, and the court system. And what Trump is now trying to do is usurp the powers of Congress. When Trump says we're going to put a halt to all funding, that is a disaster for Vermont. Courts have fought back. Some of the portals have been open, but that threat remains, that the President of the United States says, I don't care what Congress did. Congress put money into Medicaid. Congress puts money into Medicare. Hey, I'm the president. I'll do what I want to do. Very dangerous. And then you have a situation right now where you have the Vice President of the United States and Musk and others are saying, doesn't matter what the courts say. Courts say what the president is doing is unconstitutional. Who cares? We have the White House. We'll do what we want. Very, very, very dangerous, very unprecedented. So that, to me, is the moment that we're in. And in Vermont and all over this country, we have got to fight back. We may have our differences of opinion, but essentially, we have got to fight to maintain democracy and not have a handful of billionaires usurping the Constitution and running wild in Washington.
Hmm. You mentioned Elon Musk. Musk and his Doge team are doing work within federal agencies to cut federal funding Congress has already approved. To what degree are you and other senators being made aware of what's taking place within these agencies and the specifics of what the team is doing?
Let's be clear. It's not that he's going around cutting programs. He does not have the right to do that. All right. Congress has long debates. We've got a budget committee. We go through the whole process. And you allocate a certain amount of money. No one individual, not the richest guy in the world, Mr. Musk, or anybody else, has the right to say, oh, well, you know what? USAID, which keeps tens of thousands of children, the poorest children in the world, alive, feeds the hungry, you know, provides health care to the very poorest people. Oh, we're going to get rid of that agency. We don't like it. We don't like this. We don't like that. That is not how a democracy operates. So, you know, they are kind of operating in secrecy. But most importantly, they don't have the power to do what they are doing. And that is a real threat to the foundations of American democracy.
So then what happens next? I mean, you say they don't have the power to do it, but they're doing it.
Well, hopefully the courts are going to stand up to it, and hopefully the American people are going to stand up to what they are doing. I mean, that is the political struggle we are engaged in right now.
How do you rate Democratic Senate leadership's response to Trump's actions in the past month?
It's a very difficult, as I've just indicated, this is a very difficult moment. I think our job now is to rally the American people. Look, you can agree or disagree on whether or not we deal aggressively with climate change. Trump and his friends are going to dismantle virtually all of the programs that we have worked for energy efficiency and sustainable energy. You disagree with me? Okay, fine. But you cannot allow this country to sink into an autocracy and to an authoritarian society.
Do you see your Democratic colleagues in the Senate working together on some sort of unified campaign against these policies?
It's very difficult, and I think some are doing a better job than others. But again, my hope is that we come together to understand, and I don't mean to be flippant here or rhetorical, but we just cannot allow ourselves to become a government of the billionaire class, by the billionaire class, and for the billionaire class. Now, I'm a member of the Budget Committee, and what's going to be the process that will be beginning is a budget bill and a reconciliation bill, which the Republicans literally hope to be able, under Trump's leadership, to provide huge, underlying huge, tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country at a time when we have already massive income and wealth inequality, while they make incredibly large cuts in Medicaid, education, and other important programs. And when we're talking about cuts in Medicaid, that will be devastating to Vermont. Many of the people who are in nursing homes right now in our state, nursing homes in Vermont are really struggling. Nursing homes are dependent on Medicaid funding. You cut that, it's going to make a bad situation even worse. You know, we're the only major country not to guarantee health care to all people. Cut Medicaid, you're going to have more people uninsured or underinsured. Community health centers, we lead the country in terms of the percentage of our people who utilize community health centers. 40% of the income coming into community health centers because they focus on lower income people on Medicaid. Cut that, it's going to hurt community health centers. So what we are going to be engaged in very shortly is the question of whether we give gigantic tax breaks to billionaires and cut funding for programs that working people and children and the elderly depend upon.
The Senate's voting this week on a number of President Trump's cabinet picks, including Tulsi Gabbard, RFK Jr., Kash Patel. Senator Chris Murphy has suggested that Senate Democrats should not vote to confirm any of Trump's picks until Elon Musk stops his actions within federal agencies. Do you agree with that tactic?
Well, it's not going to matter all that much because the Republicans have the votes to put them through. I have voted against virtually every one of Trump's nominees because they are not good nominees. I voted for one or two because I thought they could do the job. We will see what happens in the coming weeks.
And lastly, can I ask you about your legislation that you've introduced alongside Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri to put a 10% cap on credit card interest rates? This would aim to ease credit card debt for Americans. And it aligns with President Trump's campaign promise to impose a temporary cap on credit card interest rates. Has it been difficult to work with your GOP counterparts?
On this one, he's been quite good. Look, that's exactly why we're doing it. Look, Trump said a lot of things during the campaign, and I think he will not follow through on many of those things. One of the things he said, which I happen to agree with, He said that right now you have people who are listening to this show who are struggling economically, paying off the minimum that they can on their credit cards, and then are looking at a 20-25% interest rates on the credit card. And that's just usury. That is outrageous. And the credit card companies of Wall Street make huge amounts of money. So what I've always believed, that there should be a cap on credit card interest rates. Trump proposed that during the campaign. So I said, that's great. Trump proposed it. Let's introduce it. There's a guy named Josh Hawley, senator from Missouri, very conservative guy. He agreed with me. We're going forward together. So I would love to see that implemented. It'll save working people a whole lot of money on their interest rates.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Senator Bernie Sanders spoke with Vermont Edition yesterday, February 11th. Coming up, Vermont's Attorney General Charity Clark discusses why she is suing President Donald Trump. That's in just a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. If you scroll through national headlines, you'll see a lot of phrases like this. Judge temporarily blocks Trump's cuts. Judge puts Trump program on hold. Judge orders federal department to disclose materials. Those federal judges are acting based on lawsuits filed by attorneys general from all across the country, including Vermont's Charity Clark. Clark was first elected attorney general in 2022 and reelected this past November. She and I sat down together alongside Solicitor General John Rose yesterday. Charity Clark, thank you for being on Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
And Solicitor General John Rose, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So, Attorney General, just how many lawsuits are you part of at this point?
Well, some of them are top secret, so I can't tell you the actual number, but the number of lawsuits that we filed at this recording is 4. And some of them kind of overlap. They're in different jurisdictions, but the total number is 4 right now.
And what do you see as the most pressing of these 4 cases?
The one that seems to, in my mind, have the largest impact would be the OMB memo case. And that is the case involving a federal funding freeze, very widespread in terms of a kind of topical area, from, you know, WIC to public safety, veterans issues, all types of issues were impacted. But also the amount of money at stake is very large.
And on Monday, one of the lawsuits that you filed along with 21 other states resulted in a federal judge blocking Trump's funding cuts for medical research. What was the argument that you made for blocking these cuts?
The legislative branch has been assigned the power of the purse under the Constitution. They get to spend the taxpayers' dollars. And what happened in this move by the Trump administration is that the Trump administration wanted that job themselves. And so they disregarded what Congress had decided and tried to go in a different direction. That they can't do. It's unconstitutional. And they went about it in a way that also violated the federal statutes.
And are there other cases that you've been a part of that have already slowed some of Trump's plans?
Yeah, all of the cases that we've been involved with have slowed the wishes of the Trump administration. And that is because they all violated the Constitution or federal laws. So in every one, we have prevailed in getting what's called a temporary restraining order in place, which would block the efforts that the Trump administration was putting in place.
So you said that there are these temporary restraining orders. What happens next? I mean, temporary.
Well, the next step is called a preliminary injunction. So some of these were at the period now where we are either we have one in place or we're about to perform an oral argument in front of the court arguing our case, and the other side will argue their case. And that will be of a more long-term nature if it's granted.
And Solicitor General, tell us a little bit more about your role in these complicated lawsuits that the state is a part of.
Sure. So we're looking at these executive orders as they come out from the federal government, every single one, every day they're coming out. And we're taking a look at the orders in terms of what is Vermont, what's the impact on Vermont, how can we be effective in challenging these orders, and do we have good legal arguments to stop them? And so my role is to sort of do some of the legal research and analysis around those issues. I communicate with other states who are considering filing litigation around the executive orders, and we determine whether it's right for Vermont, and we make recommendations. And Attorney General Clark reviews all the information that we provide and and decides whether Vermont should be part of that case.
Okay, that brings me to a question about this, the balance of power. Trump has been pushing back on federal judges' authority over the executive branch, and his vice president, J.D. Vance, recently stated that judges aren't allowed to control Trump's legitimate power. As you two see it, what is the judiciary's role in the legislative process?
The judiciary gets the last word. I mean, it's their job to interpret statute and constitutions. When I go to court, when John goes to court, we talk to the judge, we stand up. When the judge talks to me, I am standing up. We literally stand up for the judiciary in this country. And frankly, I was very disturbed by that comment that J.D. Vance made. I think it's un-American to disobey a court's order. I don't think the judiciary is very excited about it either, and we'll see how this plays out.
The courts are sort of the key hallmark of our system and how it works, and they stand for the rule of law and upholding the rule of law. And when we see threats to their independence, that's very troubling to all of us at the Attorney General's office.
During the first Trump administration, your office was part of, what was it, 60?
62
lawsuits. Yeah. Do you know how many you were a part of during the Biden administration?
I know we did sue the FDA under the Biden administration. John, do you remember if we have had any other lawsuits?
We didn't. I don't think we saw the level of sort of unlawfulness under the Biden administration that we've seen so far from the Trump administration. And I think, you know, we've certainly intervened in some cases or joined defensively lawsuits that relate to Biden-era policies. And we've done that recently to sort of protect some of the policies that we believe represent Vermont values at the federal level. Mm-hmm. But I think the activity was much lower during the Biden administration.
I don't know. It's such a partisan time right now that I'm kind of thinking on behalf of Vermonters who might have voted for President Trump and are saying, hey, why so many lawsuits against President Trump and not any against President Biden?
I personally think that President Trump sees himself as a bold leader who doesn't have to follow the rules. And I think that's what we're seeing play out here. And the truth is, no one is above the law, not even the president. And we all have to follow the rules.
Hmm. What has Vermonters' response been to these lawsuits? What have you been hearing?
I have been honestly stunned by the feedback that we've gotten between, my campaign email address and the work email address. I think we've gotten over 100 responses, which for us is extremely unusual. And almost all of them say the exact same thing. And the thing that they say is thank you.
The attorneys general seem to be kind of this last line of defense in many people's eyes against some of these policies.
Well, we have the power to represent our states in court. And so when Donald Trump's administration is violating the Constitution or they're violating federal law, it is my job to represent Vermont in court to uphold the rule of law. I mean, when I was sworn in, I swore an oath, and the oath literally says, I swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States. So help me God. And that is what I do every day.
What did the time between the November election and the January inauguration look like for you all? John, I'm particularly curious about you because there were a lot of these policies that Trump instituted on his first day in office were based on campaign promises. So they're things that people were kind of preparing for a while.
Yeah, that's how things were different this time around than they were last time around. That there was a sort of a playbook from the administration. We had a 900-page document in Project 2025 that he's been following pretty well since then. So we've had some time to prepare and to start to work through some of the legal strategies aimed at countering some of the worst things that he's been doing since the start of his administration. So I think, on the one hand, it's been more difficult because they've had some experience doing this now, and I think that the administration has been more prepared about how to do certain things. I think there's still been a lot of chaotic action so far from the administration, and it's caused the need to sort of sort through things that are real and in effect and things that things that he's just saying to create confusion and chaos. But at the same time, we've had more of a preview of what's going to happen this time, and so some more time to prepare. So it was certainly a busy time between November and the inauguration, for sure.
Let's turn for a moment to some local issues. The Conservation Law Foundation is suing the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources for violating the terms of the Global Warming Solutions Act and not meeting the carbon emissions goals within it. On what grounds are you arguing that the state has not violated these terms?
Well, I don't want to go into a lot of details on our defense of a case publicly, but I do feel pretty confident about this case. You know, we represent the state when the state is sued. This is an example of that. And, you know, we will continue to do that until the issue is resolved.
And you were also suing a number of large oil companies, alleging that they had covered up information about the effects of fossil fuel emissions and those effects on the environment. What is the status of that case? Can you tell us more?
Yeah, I'm really excited about that case because we actually sued before I was even attorney general, and it kind of had been languishing in court. And we are back on track after many years of that, and we're able to proceed with what's called discovery. That's the part of the lawsuit where you kind of exchange information and there's depositions and we can kind of really go ahead with that case. The premise of that case is that for generations, the fossil fuel industry was lying to us about what the impact of their products could have on the environment. And that was depriving consumers of making an informed choice about what product to buy. And that is a violation of the Consumer Protection Act. So that is what the basis of that lawsuit is. And I'm really excited to move ahead with that and be representing Vermont in that case.
One of your main focuses as Attorney General has been consumer protection. And the Trump administration has recently put a partial stop work order at the CFPB. Are you planning to take action on that? Or does it affect your work at the state level in any way?
Well, we're monitoring it very closely. You're right. I do consider myself a consumer advocate. I am a consumer lawyer. I'm also one of the reasons why I'm a consumer advocate is because when you protect consumers, you protect the marketplace. You know, consumers need to have trust to invest. And the CFPB was created, of course, in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008. And I think the CFPB does critical, critical work. It would be such a mistake to do away with that agency. Here in Vermont, we also, in addition to the work that the Attorney General's office does in the consumer space, the Department of Financial Regulation is sort of the CFPB arena. And we make referrals to them and work closely with them on issues related to consumer issues related to finance.
Are there other lawsuits that you all are actively working on putting together? Is four going to turn into 5, 6, 7, 8?
I anticipate it will. And that is because even the first day that Donald Trump took office, he put a lot of executive orders into place and has continued to put more in place since then. But a lot of them don't actually do anything other than tell an agency or a department to come up with recommendations, essentially. So they're not really actionable, even if they suggest that something that's unconstitutional or illegal be done or suggested by a department or an agency. So we're waiting to get those recommendations and other information as it becomes available to see if, again, a law was violated or the Constitution was violated.
Attorney General Charity Clark, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
And Solicitor General John Rose, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll step away from politics and hear from a local author. His new book tells the story of an Icelandic farmer reckoning with the grip that farm life has on him and his family. This is Vermont Edition. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. As many people in our region know well, working on a family farm is difficult work. There are the physical demands as well as the emotional burden of carrying on a family's legacy and livelihood. But farm life is a way of life. It wedges itself into your heart, and giving it up isn't as easy as just moving to a city and saying goodbye to what you knew. That push and pull is at the heart of Nathaniel Ian Miller's new book, Red Dog Farm. It's out next month from Little Brown and Company. He is a former journalist for newspapers in New Mexico, Colorado, Wisconsin, and Montana. His first novel, The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven, was longlisted for the Center for Fiction's First Novel Prize, and it was a finalist for the 2021 Vermont Book Award. He lives in Northfield with his family. Nathaniel, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Michaela. Thanks for having me.
So the premise of your story might be relatable to many Vermonters, but it actually takes place in Iceland.
Yes.
What is your connection to that country?
Zero connection, I would say. I mean, I've been there as a tourist, of course, and I guess my connection is that in my last book, The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven, there's a chapter late in the story where the main character, Sven, goes to Iceland and really gives it short shrift. I mean, he does not like the place, and I don't know why I felt compelled to write it that way. And then I felt guilty about it because I went there later after I'd written the book, before it had come out, and, you know, saw that the place is just staggeringly beautiful and has all this intense charm. And I thought maybe I should correct. Let's revisit this. And I was inspired by a few things that I saw there. Namely, we get to go to Vestmannaeyjar, which is the Westman Islands off the southern coast, and where there was a site of this volcanic eruption, major eruption in 1973, and a full evacuation of the island. And there was something about that really struck a chord with me visiting that island. Mm. And also just how strikingly similar their farming practices were to here in Vermont. Mm. You know, Vermont can be kind of an outlier in terms of its agricultural practices just by virtue of how it needs to be done in order to cope with the weather. Vermont has much more in common with sort of northern European farming styles, with their big marshmallow-wrapped bales, you know, and the machines required. And Iceland is sort of, it's a unique challenge just in terms of its thin, tiny, you know, thin layer of soil over just the sharpest, nastiest, igneous rock.
Wow.
How they do it, I don't know, but for years I've farmed here. We had livestock, beef cattle, for about 10 years. And during that time, people would often say, oh, you should write about that. And I never wanted to. I feel like hasn't enough been written about raising cows? But when I started to think of it in the context of maybe projecting the sort of hard-won experiences and stories that I had living in my head onto a different place with its own challenges and allure, maybe that could sort of be an avenue in which I could... Yeah. Tell some farming stories.
And so you dream up this main character named Ori, and he's a student at the University of Iceland in Reykjavik, and he finagles some permission to take a little bit of time off from his studies to help his father on his family's farm. Can you tell us a little bit more about these two worlds that he's inhabiting simultaneously?
Sure. So Ori is, you know, he's this farm kid, essentially. He's grown up there in a rural area. In this case, it's southwestern Iceland. And I think it's kind of the classic farm kid story in that, as I say in the book, it could go one of two ways. The farm kid who either can't wait to get out and live the city life and, you know, experience the wider world and really never looks back. Or maybe only in sort of fond moments of nostalgia or something like that. Or the kid who leaves and immediately sees what they've been missing and longs to return. And Ori is the latter in this case. As soon as he's in the city in Reykjavik, he is miserable. And it's only really dealt with briefly in the book, his time in the city, but he's at a loss. He's suddenly an insomniac, and he can't really cope, and he longs to return. Plus, his father back home is struggling, and so there's this sort of invitation for him to return, invitation and yet sort of unstated, to maybe stay... At least help a little while, perhaps stay a little longer, help his dad take a little break from university.
Yeah. You mentioned that you raise cattle. Is this pull back to farmland, back to a more rural setting, something that you have felt personally?
Absolutely. And there are elements of me in several of these characters, many elements. But, you know, I tried for years to get into farming. I'd worked many, many jobs out west and all kinds of fields. But my dream was to have my own place with my own animals on it. And of course, foolishly, and maybe you could say the same about our protagonist here, I really did think, you know, farming was a viable enterprise. That's a classic naive move. I thought, oh, you know, nobody seems to be able to make this work, but maybe I can. And, you know, I'd worked in ranches out west, and I'd worked with bison. I'd seen all the different, not all, but many of the different models of how it could be done or not be done, and had a number of foolish ideas myself. I thought I was going to raise bison for a while. Then I thought I was going to raise yaks.
Yaks!
Yeah. And we, actually, when we first moved out here from Montana in 2012, my wife and I went to visit a yak farmer in Waitsfield. Because we thought, well, maybe we'll buy some stock from him and get started. And not only was he delighted to meet us and sell us some animals, he tried to sell us his entire business.
Oh, boy.
And that was kind of a red flag. Like, okay, well, maybe yak is not a viable business. I mean, aside from just the word alone, like selling yak meat is maybe not the most palatable or enticing. Anyway, we ended up with cows, and just in the last year or two, I have sold them all. So we're out of it again. And for, I would say, for reasons why, check out this book. I mean, it kind of goes through the hardships, both financial and philosophical, emotional, that come along with farming and everything that entails.
Yeah. After dreaming of that life for so long, I can imagine that was a really hard decision for your family.
It was. I mean, and, you know, less so, I think, for my wife, who has, you know, she's our main breadwinner. She likes her profession as a mental health therapist. It was my thing. And there are parts of it that I still miss terribly, for sure. And I may get cows again. We're still trying to figure all that out. But yeah, it was all tied in for me with writing, as it was meant to be. Farming was the main thing, or at least half the thing, and writing the other half. And no surprise to anyone that, you know, my writing was slow to take off and to be read by any living soul. So in the meantime, I sort of had to devote myself to farming, and that became most of my self, my identity. And that those proportions have now shifted now that I have a couple of books in the world.
Yeah. The parallels between a Vermont farm and an Icelandic farm are many.
Yes.
As you can tell from your book, there's beautiful and visceral descriptions of farm life and of the seasons, of mud season, for example.
Right.
I'd like to ask you to read one passage.
Sure.
That I believe takes place during mud season.
Yeah.
On the farm.
Yes.
I'll let you take it from here.
And I'd be happy to. And I should note that for purposes of, you know, fact-checking and everything else, tone, this was read by a number of Icelandic people, including one who grew up on a farm and helped me a great deal, named Gudmundur Thorvaldsson. And I think it might have been this section that he read. And he didn't so much flag it as make certain I knew that if any farm, this is his take, any farm in Iceland actually looked or smelled quite this bad, you know, it would be It would be basically fined by their equivalent of the health department. You know, like, they, nobody would let this slide in Iceland.
All right, so, no shade to Icelandic farmers.
And maybe that Vermont farming is just inherently a little grosser. But so, with that said, in Reykjavik, I had been a sleepwalker. Not literally, of course, for a sleepwalker must sleep. The city stultified. All things seemed draped in gauze, and every meal took on the consistency and flavor of boiled rice. Music, previously a reliable refuge, became dangerous. It lost the power to elicit anything but pain. Now that I was rested and back in the fetid embrace of farmland in springtime, my senses were awake. The more putrid, the better, it seemed. The squelch and suck as my boot was claimed by deeper layers of submerged muck, and my socked foot hovered perilously in the air, was a source of great amusement. The oily slick of standing wastewater shimmered with rainbows. Rikuch's pleasure at the filth was irrepressible and contagious. She ran in tight circles, kicking up a spray of mud that dripped from her belly and haunches, and tried again and again to sneak around the other side of the barn and consume a rotting placenta. Even the pervasive stench that rose from the mud, very unlike fresh manure in that it was brinier, funkier, and fermented, could seize and shake me with its appalling novelty. And the sound of Papi's dirt bike starting up after a long winter of disuse, coughing and sputtering in objection to the clogged carburetor, the old gas, the carbonized spark plug, was like the throat clearing of an old friend. So he's really putting a positive spin on things.
Well, that passage reminds me of something else that you wrote in the book, that a real working farm isn't a tourist attraction.
Right.
And in this time where agribusiness and ecotourism are in some ways ways that farmers can make a living in these, you know, difficult mm-hmm. economic times, especially for a small farm. It also seems like sometimes that can lead to a kind of glossing over of farm life.
Yes.
Is that something that you wanted to explore in this book?
In a way, for sure. I mean, it's something that I certainly thought about a great deal while we were more actively farming. Some of that's by necessity in that, you know, when people say, oh, you should have a B&B or you should rent out your barn, which some of our friends have done and really had, that's saved their butts mm-hmm. at a number of times. You know, that's something I just can't do because I'm too prickly. but so, you know, that's what I mean by necessity. But absolutely, you're right in that the glossing over, I mean, it's just one sort of layer of fiction over the realities of farming, I think. And the sort of Instagramification of farms, that kind of, that sheen, as you're saying, it can be misleading for sure. Mm. And then, you know, if people were to visit you during mud season and see...
No one visits during mud season.
Right. And who would win? Who can blame them? yes. So I did want to touch on that. The father in this book, Papi, who I have unfortunately a lot in common with, he takes it to sort of an extreme in that he really doesn't want to do anything that's going to invite anyone or make us any compromises in that direction. He doesn't even have horses. And in Iceland, to not have an Icelandic horse or a herd of them on your farm is anathema. I mean, it's just, he would be a pariah.
Yeah.
And I think he sort of is in this book.
You mentioned earlier that you spent a fair amount of time in Iceland researching this book. Tell us a little bit more about that process.
Sure. I mean, I wish I could tell you that it was sort of well thought out and organized. I ended up spending less time than I'd hoped to, although it changed the work, I think, for the better, in that initially I was going to spend half my time in the Westman Islands, and much of this book was going to take place there. I ended up lingering longer in the farm country, essentially. And as I said, I had a wonderful friend and guide who took me around, told me so much of the kind of weird, occasionally sordid history of the communities around there. And, you know, I took copious notes and a million photographs. I mean, if as I think some writers have really well intentioned, if not well executed, plans for their research, I tend to just sort of wing it. The same way I did for Sven, I had this artist residency aboard a ship in, around Svalbard. And what did I do? I just took a million notes and a lot of photographs and then slowly processed it over a very long time. I think I have to just sort of let it wash over me.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the Memoirs of Stockholm Sven. That was your debut novel. There are definitely some similarities between that book and this one. Mm-hmm. There's the harsh northern settings and the coming of age themes and right. these protagonists with these strong, sometimes prickly personalities. Mm-hmm. And in Stockholm Sven, a man essentially banishes himself to a solitary life in the Arctic Circle, and then he's sort of rescued by all these different characters, including a loyal dog. I'm guessing you're probably a dog person.
Yes. Although in the last maybe month, I have had to ask myself, am I also maybe a cat person?
Wow.
I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. But yes, go on.
Tell us a little bit more about these two characters and whether I'm always curious if you if authors ever think about their protagonists living in the same world and interacting with one another. They like each other.
I think about that a great deal. In some senses, I was really pushing against that, but I can't hide from who I am. And there are certain themes that I like. And, you know, prickly people being sort of drawn out by their circumstances or the people around them to show a little warmth and, you know, a very dry wit and things like that, and companionship of animals and the warmth of human companionship is essentially cutting through harsh conditions or atmosphere. These are things I return to over and over again. And really also how humans can cope with seclusion and alienation. And I mean, in that sense, I'm always writing the same book.
Hmm. Well, another through line is that the same person who read the audiobook for Stockholm Sven reads the audiobook for Red Dog Farm.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the interesting backstory about how you two got connected?
Sure. So we're talking about Ólafur Darri Ólafsson, who's, you know, one of my heroes, and now I'm delighted to say a friend, and helped me a great deal with this book, Red Dog Farm, just in terms of not only reading it and helping me with accuracy, but fixing, you know, he put me in touch with everyone I met there. Mm. But he's all over the place as a character actor in, you know, in American films as well. And I happened to be watching at that time, right when it came out, the very silly but entertaining movie Eurovision Song Contest with
yep.
Will Ferrell.
And great film. Very familiar.
You know, I think everybody watched that right as COVID was kind of breaking.
Yeah.
And
we
needed it. And I'm watching that movie, and Darri is in it. And I'm not sure if I knew that he was in it. He plays a sort of, I couldn't exactly tell you what his role in the movie is. He's sort of a suit in Iceland, weighing in about who's going to get to go to Eurovision. He seems to be kind of the head suit. And I heard his voice rumbling out of the TV, and it sounds like somebody has turned up the bass of, you know, like a Doom sludge amp, like a Sun Model T, and all the way to 10 and broken the knob off. I mean, it's this deep rumbling boom that you can feel in your chest. And on top of that, I think he's a brilliant actor, and he imbues his characters with all this depth and pathos and gravitas mm-hmm. and all those things. But when I heard him ridiculously in Eurovision, you know, I turned to my wife and said, oh my God, can you imagine if he could read Sven? So I started asking for that. And I wrote crazy long emails detailing, you know, 25 different reasons why he was the perfect reader. And here's his, you know, here's the information of his voice agent, and because he does voiceover work, but he'd never done an audiobook, I think. And it paid off, I mean, miraculously.
A lot of writers that I've spoken to on this show are attracted to Vermont life because of one of two things, and sometimes because of both. One is the solitary nature of life here and the way that that opens up time and mental space to write, and also the community of writers that exist in this state and people who have dedicated their lives to that craft. Are either or both of those things important to you in your life here as a writer?
Absolutely. I would say the first more than the second in that, I mean, it'll come as no surprise to anyone who's read my work that, you know, I'm not the most active member of any community, I guess that goes hand in hand with the solitary nature of the work, but also just my own solitary nature. Hopefully not reclusive, not misanthropic, but I do require a fair amount of time alone. And, you know, I've never been to AWP and never will. So, you know, I'm not that kind of writer, and I'm terrible at schmoozing. Parties make me nervous, so, you know, I love the part of the writing community around here that I can engage with sort of at my, like, at hands, what's the expression, at arm's length?
Yeah, just do a little Vermont wave.
Right, the Vermont wave, exactly. But, yeah, certainly living on a farm is conducive to my writing, in that I do require a fair amount of time and quiet. So, yeah, about the sound of my dog snoring at my feet is about as noisy as it gets in the background while I'm working.
Well, despite being something of a self-described recluse, you are kicking off a book tour pretty soon, starting at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier on March 4th. Where are you headed to after that?
So there are a few events, mostly regional stuff in March. A few around Vermont. We're going to Norwich. We're going to Manchester Center, of course. And then heading down to New York and Hoboken and Connecticut for a little sort of jaunt down there. And then back to France for actually the third time. It'll be my third little mini tour there. The French edition of Sven did pretty well, and the readers over there have been incredibly supportive and eager for the next one. And as happens somewhat rarely, because I became friends with my French editor over there, they're able to publish Red Dog Farm, which in French is going to be called Dans nos pierres et dans nos os, which is a line from the book that means in our rocks and in our bones. They're going to publish only a month after. Usually it's a long lead, sort of a lag after the U.S. publication before an overseas publisher can publish, because they've got to do the translation and everything else and figure out the marketing. But in this case, the French edition will come out a month later, and I'll be over there, you know, doing my weird routine from city to city.
Do you speak French?
Barely. Barely.
Well, what an adventure. That's great to hear that it's caught on across the ocean.
Very strange and surreal, but gratifying.
Yeah. Nathaniel Ian Miller is the author of Red Dog Farm. Nathaniel, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Michaela. It was really fun.
That is it for today. On the next Vermont Edition, we're going to honor Valentine's Day by celebrating love. Platonic love, that is. You might not have a romantic partner right now, but that doesn't mean you don't have love in your life. The love of a dear friend. We're going to share stories of friendships that have carried us through dark times and lifted us up during good times. And we want to hear about your best friend. Email VermontEdition@vermontpublic.org and join our show tomorrow at noon.
Vermont Edition's managing producer is John Ahrens. Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro are our producers. Anna Berg is our intern, and our theme music is by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.